Well, good morning, everyone. We're glad that you're here, and thank you for, as Calvin said, being concerned about the things that matter. I really appreciate the guys that do our table talks for the Lord's Supper. You can tell they think about it. They put a lot of work into it, and I've been at places, probably you have too, where it's sort of the rote thing, and it just always is sort of the same. Go to the same passages, and again, to make something fresh and think about a different way, these guys do a good job at that. So compliment them if you haven't had the chance to do that. Really appreciate what they do. Who do you trust, yourself or God? That is a hard question when we really get down to thinking about who Jesus is. He tells us baffling things. In John 6, verse 53, so Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. I've heard people use that chapter of the Lord's Supper. I don't mean to correct anybody that might think that that is so and has done it. I don't think that's what that passage is talking about. I think it's something entirely different than the Lord's Supper. He's using very figurative language, but I hear people sometimes use that at the Lord's Supper table. It's baffling. That's why some people may think you can do that and others would not see it that way. He tells us offensive things. Matthew chapter 10, verse 34 through 37. If you love father or mother more than me, if you love son or daughter more than me, there's no one you can love more than Jesus. And I'll tell you, that's going to offend. There's going to be a lot of people that don't walk with God simply because they cannot see their way through that. He tells us hard things to do. Luke 6, 27. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. A friend of mine who's a well-known gospel preacher is, because of being in the position he's in, been shot at a considerable amount. And that sort of thing happens in life. And a particular guy who had shot at him again and again and again, his wife had to have surgery. And my friend made it the point to go all the way down to a major metropolitan area to a huge medical complex and sit with his enemy during that surgery. You think that's a very easy thing to do? You think you would even think about doing that? You know, the supreme question when we come to who do we trust, ourselves or God, is to ask, who is this Jesus and what will I do with him? Or to ask it another way, will I filter the commands of God through my experiences and what I feel and what I think I know? Or will I just listen to the voice of God and believe and obey without question? Look in Luke chapter 5, if you will with me, verses 1 through 8 of this chapter. On this occasion, Jesus has, in the beginning, calling his disciples. And Luke tells us a very, very interesting account. The disciples are fishermen, as you remember. Peter, James, John, Andrew. They're all fishermen, professional fishermen. That's their life. They know the Sea of Galilee. And they have come in from all night of fishing. And they're washing their nets, meaning that they're going to go home and go to bed. They are like my son Jonathan, who works all night long, and when it comes daylight, the opposite of you and me, he's ready to go to bed. And that's what they're about to do. But in the process of the crowds pushing in on Jesus, he says to Simon, still calling him that in this text, put out your boat a little bit on the water, sort of that amplifying sound that he could talk in a voice that could be heard because of what water would do. And he taught the people. And when he was through teaching them, it says that he said to Simon at verse 4, put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Now that's simple enough command. You have a decision to make. And the point that he's going to be teaching Peter and the others is the most vital thing that we can address. What do you do with Jesus? Now, Peter begins the whirling in his mind. Master, we have toiled all night and took nothing. Is he about to, as a professional fisherman who knows the Sea of Galilee like the back of his hand, allow someone who doesn't know one blooming thing, as we would say about fishing, he's a carpenter. Is he going to let a man who he knows is just simply a carpenter tell him what to do about fishing? Is he going to go by Peter's experience of the Sea of Galilee? Is he going to go on what he knows and what he believes? But he's already encountered enough of Jesus to know that reluctantly he needs to do this. He says, but even though I'm arguing with you, that you don't know anything about fishing, we've been out all night, but at your word, I will let down the nets. And when they had done this, they enclosed a large number of fish, and their nets were breaking. There were so many fish. They signaled to their partners, John and James, and they came with the other boat, and they began to fill it, it says, until the boats began to sink. Can you imagine how many fish they caught? All night they fished nothing. Now, bam, because Jesus said, go out and let down your nets in the deep. And when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees and said, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, Lord. Well, we need more of that. We need more of us who would say, falling down on our knees, depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O God. What about Genesis 22? You know, as we studied the book of Genesis, that great story of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham has been given a son after many, many days that were difficult, trusting God until they tottered on into old age. Now it's just impossible from a physical standpoint that Sarah could even give birth. Their bodies, both Romans says, both their bodies were as good as dead. Now commanded by God to kill his only son, Isaac, the son of promise. And if he didn't have enough problems with that from an ethical standpoint, from a right and wrong standpoint, what's going to happen to the promises of God? Not only will Isaac be killed, but he will offer him up as a burnt offering, meaning that his body will be burned to ash. And yet, Abraham somehow works it out in his mind that God, and here's why he's called the father of the faithful. Here's why he's the father of faith, is that he trusted God no matter if he could understand. He didn't filter God's command through Abraham's experience and knowledge. Abraham trusts God completely and leaves it to God to fulfill his promises. And know that Abraham's part is to never doubt God and disobey him. Had you asked Abraham as he went on that journey to Moriah, and he had a lot of time to think about it, he had 3 days, and with alacrity he arose the next morning after the command and saddled the donkeys and took the servants and the wood and all of it and Isaac, and he went. What are you doing, Abraham, if we were to ask him? How will God work this out? I suppose Abraham would have responded to us, I don't know. But I know who God is, and it will be okay. I cannot imagine as a father, nor do I think sometimes we think about Isaac sort of being the milquetoast guy of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But Isaac will never forget, nor will it ever leave anybody, if we'll think about it, the knife being held for him by his own father, ready to plunge into his body or slit his throat. Isaac, who also had to submit, I think he could have run away. I think that he might could have overpowered such an old man. But you remember Isaac submitted too. The faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that all of us would say, you are a fool to do this. But Abraham, as Genesis 15 and verse 6 says, believed God, and God counted it to him for righteousness. And so, folks, we too will be baffled by God. In John, the 6th chapter, you know the story that is told there at the end of that, talking about eating my flesh and drinking my blood. And when many of his disciples, verse 60, heard it, they said, this is a hard saying. Who can listen to it? Boy, write that down about many a thing that Jesus says. But Jesus, knowing in himself that his disciples were grumbling about this, imagine that's you and me, said to them, "Do you take offense at this?" And then to all of those that walked away, I mean the ones that didn't walk away, it says that several of them did. After this, many of his disciples, verse 66, turned back and no longer walked with him. They filtered what he was saying through their experiences and their knowledge, and they said, this is just a bunch of junk. And so Jesus said to the 12, "Do you want to go away too?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." Marvelous Peter. It could be one way, one time, and yet say things that were just so right on. We will have lots of questions about Jesus that my life experiences and knowledge simply cannot reconcile with what I know. Or will we say, will we walk away like the others, or will we say with Peter, "We know who you are, Jesus. Now, I don't understand what you're saying, and I don't comprehend all of this." He wouldn't comprehend when he said to them, I'm going to Jerusalem, they're going to kill me, but the third day I will rise." And Peter, on that occasion, will do the right opposite of this. Take him aside and rebuke him for saying it. And you remember that Jesus rebuked him and said, "Get behind me, Satan." But all along, Peter was still this man. "I'll stay right here, and the rest of us are staying right here, and we will follow you to the end." So why will we follow Jesus? No matter what he says, we bring it to our time. This Jewish peasant of so many centuries ago, and we follow him today in Northwest Arkansas, or wherever we live, wherever you are watching this morning. Why do we follow him? And the answer is one simple thing. He alone, of all men, has been raised from the dead to life again. And so that he is declared, as the book of Romans says to us, by the power of God to resurrect him, he is declared to be the Son of God. And the very essence of the gospel's message, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 1 through 4, "I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel, the good news that I preached to you, which you received, you accepted it, in which you stand in it, and by which you are saved. This is the difference for all mankind between being lost and being saved." What do you do with the good news about Jesus? "If you hold fast the word that I have preached to you, unless you have believed in vain, here's the gospel. For I am delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and he goes into all of these witnesses. In fact, one time above 500 brethren saw him alive. The greater part of them, he says, are still alive. You want to know? Go interview them. We every day, and all of us probably have sat on a jury, and we've had to listen to people testify that we didn't know. In fact, the lawyers are going to make sure you don't know them. In voir dire, they're going to X you out if you had any real connection to anybody in the case. They want the most impartial jury to listen to the evidence that both sides are going to try to manipulate the facts. But in the end, that common sense will take, and 12 people or whoever many, 9 that are on a particular different jury, at least it was in Texas, that you will decide the fate of somebody or the civil circumstances of a case like that based upon what you didn't see, what you didn't hear, but yet you believe. There's no reason to doubt the people that are testifying. That most powerful testimony is the same that teaches us about Jesus Christ. Folks, he goes on to say in 1 Corinthians 15, "If this fact be not so, if Jesus is not raised, then our faith is empty and everything we're doing this morning is pointless and meaningless, and everybody can laugh at us on the outside because they think, what fools. If Jesus be not raised from the dead, the whole gospel is a fraud." And the apostles were either consummate liars, knowing that it wasn't true, they foisted this tale upon all of humanity for the rest of time, or they were the most deluded men of all time. Yet, when you deal with the facts and what happened to them, not one of them ever broke rank and denied the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Not once when they were tortured. Do you know what the story of Mark is told? Once I saw this on a movie where they chained every limb of a guy to horses. In fact, more than one. And then started them all galloping in the opposite direction of the man. Do you know what happens when they reach the end of their tether? The guy's body's ripped apart. That's what happened, history tells us, to Mark. All of them died violent deaths. Violent deaths. Peter crucified. At his request, it seems, upside down. Paul was beheaded because he was a Roman citizen. On and on the story goes. James, we know, was killed in the book of Acts. In the face of ridicule from powerful people, Paul, Festus cried out, in the middle of his speech about the resurrection of Jesus, "You are out of your mind. Your much learning is driving you mad." And Paul's response was, imagine standing before the most powerful people in your country. "I am not out of my mind, most noble Festus, but speak to you true and rational words." These men didn't get rich out of what they preached. Gold and silver and wealth did not come to them. They rather were beaten, imprisoned, prison killed. Read Paul when he tells us about what happened. And we're the offscouring of all things until now. Yet not one of them ever broke rank and said it was a lie. We made it all up. As one has said in modern times, the men are no sufficient reason for the story, but the story is all sufficient to explain the men. Chuck Colson may not mean much to you, particularly if you are 35 or 40 probably, younger. But you might know who he is. He's dead now. He was the lead counsel to Richard Nixon. I've been to several presidential libraries. I can never go to Richard Nixon's without feeling what a failure, what a shame, and because of Watergate. They think that they need to get in and get the goods on the opposite, and they break the law. And they all go to prison one by one. They began to break, starting with John Dean. And Chuck Colson would in prison become, quote unquote, a Christian. The rest of his life he would spend defending the faith. And from that angle, he was right. He did good from that. But Chuck Colson has a book called Loving God and a chapter in it called Watergate and the Resurrection. The first time that I read that, it was a powerful example of a man who was at the top echelons of power. He said, "We could call anybody. A plane would be there to take us anywhere when you're at that highest echelon of government. I could call the National Art Gallery and famous paintings could be delivered to my office to be hung on my wall because we were that high up in government. Budgets that manage millions and millions of people, hundreds of thousands of folks at work sometimes underneath them, all of it, and directly just go and talk to the President of the United States." And he said, "When we had a conspiracy, a true conspiracy, we couldn't hold it together for 2 weeks until one by one, beginning with John Dean, we broke because they knew it was a lie." And he says, "And nobody was threatening us with death. Imprisonment, they weren't going to kill us. And we had all the money and the power in the world. And we gave it up in 2 weeks. I am a Christian because of the overwhelming evidence of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Therefore, when I confess his name, that he is who he claimed to be, and that he is Lord of my life, I believe whatever he says because of the resurrection from the dead, and I will do whatever he says to do." So someone comes along and says, "You mean you believe in a literal creation of the physical world? And I answered them, yes, because Jesus believed it. Darwinian evolution is a lie. You can't go anywhere in our day and age. You Google it, as I did, to ask some questions, and immediately everything is explained in terms of evolution, Darwinian evolution, not just the minor changes in species. You realize that there's every kind of dog in the world. You can have a Chihuahua or a Great Dane. I've never understood Chihuahuas, and I've never understood dogs that are on that end of the thing. I want a dog that, you know, if I need them to attack the postman, I need that kind of dog. I don't want them to attack the postman. But if I'm going to be in danger, I don't want a Chihuahua. But you realize a Chihuahua is a dog. So is a Great Dane. There is change that's possible in a species, but not macroevolution. Not the fact that something came out, crawled out on the shore, and then somehow it managed to go upward, and it got more complex and more complex until you had some kind of ape-like creatures, and then kind of precursor of men, and then finally Homo sapiens. I'll tell you what you find in the fossil record. You find nothing hardly below, minor kinds of things, not complex life. Maybe we're talking about bacteria and things like that, algae. But you come to what they call the Cambrian age, and there is an explosion of fossils, an explosion of life, complex, skeletons, vertebrae, all of those things that... And you ask the question, if Darwinian evolution was correct, shouldn't you see the littlest forms, and then there ought to be something in between, and then there, and it ought to, there, shouldn't you see that in the geological column? Because the creation column would say you would expect, with the great flood or whatever else we want to say, both of those are arguments, there would be an explosion. It's not, and then it is. And it is in complex forms that still exist. Some of those creatures, many, many of those creatures still exist to our day. I believe in the creation account of Genesis 1 and 2 because Jesus believed it. And he was raised from the dead, and that is my assurance. My confidence in him is absolute. In Matthew 19, verses 4 through 6, he answered them the question when they asked, can a man divorce his wife on any occasion for anything? He said, have you not read that he who created, that word from nothing, created them from the beginning or in the beginning, made them male and female, and said, here's consequences that follow because of the fact that he's creator. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together. Here's the consequences of him being Lord. Let no man, including the two people, separate. I believe in a literal creation. I believe exactly the words of Genesis 1 and 2. Because Jesus believed it. Someone comes along and says, surely you don't believe in a worldwide Noachian flood. Yes, I do. Because Jesus believed it in Genesis chapter 6 through 9, that it literally happened. Can I explain everything scientifically in the limited kind of way that I would be able to do those things? Not always, and maybe not sufficiently to convince everyone. But I believe because Jesus believed. And Jesus, the evidence is overwhelming, arose from the dead. And so when Jesus says in Matthew chapter 24, verses 37 through 39, for as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Folks, if Jesus coming back is not literal, then neither is Noah's flood. If Noah's flood is not literal, then neither is Jesus' coming back. You can't compare a fictional thing to a literal thing. He is saying when Noah entered the ark. These are facts. And Jesus believed it. Somebody finally says, surely, goodness. You don't believe the story about the great fish swallowing Jonah. I mean, surely you're too sophisticated and knowledgeable for that. And my answer is the same. Jesus believed it. It was a fact. And I believe it too. But how, they ask, could a great fish swallow a man and remain alive within it and then be vomited out on the shore and live? If you're just asking from a naturalistic viewpoint, that's not possible. But with God, all things are possible. I know the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. Therefore, I believe in Jesus and whatever he says. And so Jesus believed that the account of Jonah was factual. In Matthew 12, verse 39 and 40, but he answered them, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as, listen to him, the comparison, for just as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. Folks, you ask the same question. If Jonah was not literally in the belly of the great fish for 3 days and 3 nights, then Jesus was not literally in the heart of the earth for 3 days and 3 nights. If one is fiction, the other is too. If one is literal, so is the other. And Jesus believed it. And I believe it because of the overwhelming evidence of his resurrection. So how do I get a faith like Peter's? How do I get a faith especially like Abraham? Without question, no matter what God says, I will do it. First of all, let me suggest to you that like Peter, we need to say, do you remember what he said? Nevertheless, he argued with him a little bit. I can't believe it. We're not going to let out here. We've been fishing all night. But nevertheless, at your word. Never look at my experiences and what I think, what ought to be about something. The apostles had equal authority. Sometimes people say, I just want the red letters of Jesus. No, the apostles had equal authority of Jesus' words. Here are Jesus' words if you want to read it in the red letters. That came later. You know, that doesn't matter. Luke 10, verse 16. All the words are the words of God. Here's Jesus in the red letters. The one who hears you, he's speaking to the apostles, hears me. And the one who rejects you rejects me. And the one that rejects me rejects him that sent me. You don't receive the apostles and what they write. You don't receive Jesus and you don't receive God the Father if you reject the apostles. In Matthew 10, verse 40, whoever receives you receives me and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. The apostles were sent out. That's what the word apostle means by Jesus, with his words and his authority. And anything they spoke must be received too if we want Jesus. In Acts 2, verse 42, the very first thing it says the disciples did when they obeyed the gospel and were baptized into Jesus, and they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching or their doctrine. They are sent out with his authority. So that Paul could write in 1 Corinthians 14:37, if anyone thinks he's a prophet or spiritual, he should acknowledge that the things I am writing to you are a command of the Lord Jesus Christ. So no matter how hard and difficult the thing that Jesus says to us to do, I will believe it and not filter Jesus' words through what I think. Somebody introduced us to the series a while. I mean, it's been a good while back, Downton Abbey, and so we got into it. We started watching it, and there's a story in there told about a guy who falls in love with one of the daughters of the Earl of Grantham, whose wife is in a mental institution, and under the law of England at that time, he couldn't just marry anybody, and he loved her, and he just said, "I'm married to somebody that doesn't even know who I am." Listen, Timmy, the world doesn't think like God does. If my spouse entered a mental asylum, that does not free me to marry somebody else. Yeah, I'm going to have a hard life. There's going to be a lot of bitterness. There's going to be a lot of disappointment. But God isn't about happiness. He's about holiness. He's about seeking us to be sanctified, to become like his Son. And sometimes, folks, you're not going to be happy. In fact, maybe a great deal of time, because of the service of God that we must render. If there is no adultery, if there is no death in a marriage, you do not have the right to marry someone else. And the Scriptures are plain about that. I don't filter what Jesus says about a command, no matter how difficult it is, filter it through my experiences and through what I think and what I want. Thirdly, like Peter, I'm going to have, in Abraham, a great humility of spirit. Peter had to forget everything he knew about fishing if he was going to obey Jesus Christ. Abraham had to trust God, even though every fiber of his being was a father and of one who believed in God and didn't think he was like the Canaanite gods who commanded that often to sacrifice children. Abraham had to overcome all of that if he was going to obey God. Someone says, you can't expect young people to not have sex with their boyfriend and girlfriend. It's just not possible. In our day and age, it's asking too much. No, it isn't. Not if you believe Jesus and His apostles, 1 Corinthians 6:18, flee from sexual immorality, period. Everything outside the marriage of a man to a woman, that union sacred before God until death do they part, anything else is sexual immorality. You can't expect somebody comes along, to stay married for life. People grow up hard. Hard things happen to them. It's just too hard to expect of that. No, it's not. If you know who Jesus is, no matter what you have to deal with, you will deal with it. Because that's what Jesus wants you to do. And I will not filter Jesus' words through my experiences. So they are no longer two. These are the consequences of creating male and female. They're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. Done a lot of marriage ceremonies, particularly being down at A&M. I recently had to cancel out on one because of the COVID thing. But when I do stand before them and I look at these two giddy young people on the first day, and any of you that have been married for any length of time know what I'm saying. You look at these two young people with all the promise that stands before them and you think you have not one clue what you're getting into. You have no idea how hard this is going to be at times. And some of you right now are looking at me going, what? Well, just wait. Wait. But that's not going to free you from the command of Almighty God that what God has joined together, no matter how difficult it is, let not man put asunder. And then, lastly, we're going to be fools to the world. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18 and 19, let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks he is wise in this age, let him become a fool, that he may become wise, for the wisdom of this world is folly with God. There are so many learned men, sages, college professors, PhDs, and lesser minds that sit in judgment upon the Creator and Lord of this life. Listen, the world is too smart and too intelligent to believe the Bible stories that we talked about earlier. But are we going to trust Jesus or our own puny knowledge? How many times have scientists had to change what they believed about something because they discovered something else? And all through history of science, that's been so. And if you're basing what you believe about something first upon science, upon the knowledge of men, you're in for a heap of trouble. Because the first thing we need to trust is God, is the words, the simple words of Jesus, as hard as they may be. Yeah, I know some of them are baffling, but not all of them are baffling. Some of them are just hard because we can't plumb it with what we know. We're going to trust in our puny knowledge. I'm going to tell you what will happen to us. God will come to us and say, thou fool. this night thy soul will be required of thee, and then what of thy puny knowledge? Paul Earnhardt said these words, if God isn't any smarter than the rest of us, we're in a heap of trouble. God is so vastly beyond us that we need to listen to his words. And so the lesson is yours with this thought. Whatever Jesus says, I believe because I know who he is. Do you believe that? Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He that believes not shall be condemned. I can't explain to you why does he want us to be immersed in water. But I guarantee you, none of those people on the day of Pentecost said, you know, I believe in Jesus, but Peter, wait a minute. This baptism thing. You think anybody said that? Or they just said, what a privilege to be able to obey what an apostle of Jesus Christ is telling me to do and be saved from my sins. All together we stand and sing.
And we're all.